Welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 14th of June 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another glorious week in Blighty and that means you are here today to listen to myself and my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring discussing the news and also getting into our greatest Britons. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Good day to you as well. Yes, I'm absolutely luxuriating in the wonderful weather that we're having. It's really good to see so much sunshine. And following on from the wet spring that we've had, we've got lots of greenery. And I don't think I've ever seen England looking so green.
It is absolutely beautiful, isn't it, Britain in the summertime? Of course, I'm in Wales, so I get the beautiful Wales countryside. And our great and glorious leaders have been enjoying the Cornish countryside. The self-appointed G7 have been meeting in Cornwall over the weekend. And that's been quite entertaining to see. They all arrived wearing masks and doing this ludicrous elbow bumping thing, which just does look so ridiculous watching them do that. And within a few hours, they were all masks off and hugging one another and with their arms around one another, and just looked very, very hypocritical considering anybody else comes into Britain. They've got a quarantine, I think, for 10 days or something silly like that. And Boris Johnson has been sucking up to Joe Biden. I just saw Joe Biden give a press conference and he spent 2 minutes mumbling and muttering about Libya and Syria and Russia and completely lost the thread of what he was actually talking about by the time he finished. One good bit, I thought, was Boris Johnson running into the ice cold sea head first and having a swim. And I did think, well, yeah, that's pretty good going of him to get into the British water at this time of year. I guess he was really sort of emulating Putin there, the sort of hard man thing. And we've also had Justin Trudeau there. And I do wonder, what's Canada got to do with the G7? He just looks really out of place when you see all the rest of them there. And then you suddenly see Justin Trudeau. He just looks like, I don't know, a spare wheel. Just wonder quite what he's doing there. And the Queen was there as well. And all the royal family were there. In fact, they're making a big point of the fact that we have the royal family, I think. And she had to cut the cake and they gave her a sword to cut the cake with. And that looked a little bit difficult for her to actually do. I mean, really, you have the sword for occasions and for knighting people, but it's not really very sensible for cutting the cake with. And they had a band, they had live music, they had the sea shanty men from Cornwall that were singing. I'm sure they must have enjoyed that. And they had the whole beach to themselves. The rest of the Cornish have to put up with everybody else on the beach, but for the G7 guys, they end up with the whole beach to themselves. It's nice to see that it was good weather for them, but I'm not so sure about how important a role it is that they actually play, because the week before they had the World Economic Forum in St. Petersburg and they had representatives of Qatar there, one of the richest countries. They had Saudi Arabia there. Of course, they had China there and they're all doing business, and Russia is not allowed at the G7. And then you have this G7 meeting, and it's all the liberal democracies, basically, and they're sort of waffling about human rights and pushing that all around the world. And it just really seemed to be irrelevant now, this G7. I think they've got the G20 coming up, whatever that means. It's a multipolar world now, and they seem to be forgetting that. But yeah, that's my sort of summary of the G7, Max. Have you seen any of this? And the BBC have been making a huge fuss about it, and that they've been devoting lots of time to it, and also the fact that Donald Trump isn't there and Joe Biden is there. But I can't really see any deals being done with Joe Biden, to be honest. Oh, and Macron has also likened the Northern Ireland as if Northern Ireland is not actually a part of Britain, which was quite insulting. But yeah, that's my summary of it all. Have you caught any of the G7 coverage at all, Max? Got any thoughts on it?
I think my thoughts are fairly similar to yours, really, in that it just looks like one great big bun fight, really, doesn't it? They're all turning up, they're all parading around and posturing and making all sorts of noises in sound bites so that they can be reported. But they generally speaking seem to be having a lot of fun, despite the fact there's supposed to be hard-nosed negotiation taking place. And as you pointed out, they've been strolling along the beach. They've been splashing in the waves, or at least Boris Johnson has done. And all the lady folk have been parading in their finery, and the newspapers have been sort of having an orgy of discussing all the sort of, I think it was
Princess Nut Nut.
Yellow shoes and yellow handbag and things like this are going on about, which is all totally irrelevant. And as you say, you know, what serious business will they actually be doing? It's more, I think, a matter that they're getting together ostensibly on the basis that if they all get together and have a meeting where there is lots of leisure time and there's the drink flows and it's in a beautiful balmy location with sunny weather, etc., it's almost like going on holiday together, and that kind of thing is intended to try and generate some rapport that will enable breakthroughs to be made in the negotiations between various countries. Whether or not those breakthroughs actually get made, or whether the posturing just continues and they will go home without actually having decided anything of any value, that's anybody's guess, really, isn't it?
Yeah, they also had the EU there. They've got Ursula von der Leyen and this Michel guy as well. He's because they've got a twin leadership of the European Union at the moment. They've got one male and they've got one female. Both of them were there, and they're not actually part of the G7. Then you got Macron there as well, who was insulting Britain and pretending that Northern Ireland was not a part of Great Britain, like Wales and Scotland are. And Boris Johnson was saying, well, what about Toulouse? Is that a part of France? And they're sort of pointing out that they wouldn't talk about parts of Spain as if they weren't parts of Spain. They wouldn't talk about Catalonia as if it was separate to Spain. So why is he doing that about Northern Ireland? And then you've got all this fake friendship, and they're all hugging one another. It's very, very cringe-inducing actually to see what is going on. And you do think, well, all the Cornish that would normally be on that beach, they're not allowed to go on the beach. And there haven't actually been any protests either. I guess the Cornish are just really not that interested at what's going on with the G7 there. We've also got the football. That's been taking up the news a lot, and not actually the football itself, but the Black Lives Matter kneeling down before Black Lives Matter situation. And the England team have said that they're all going to get down on their knees, and Scotland have said they're going to refuse to do that. Croatia refused to do that the other day. And when the England team did all get down on their knees, there was loads of booing. And they've been trying to shame the supporters. They've been trying to shame the supporters into supporting Black Lives Matter. I saw a BBC News piece the other day, and she was saying, well, it's anti-racism. If you're anti-racism, then you've got to support Black Lives Matter. But the point is, Black Lives Matter supported the destruction of our statues. They pulled down the Edward Colston statue. They graffitied on Winston Churchill. They graffitied on a statue of Queen Victoria. They've initiated a big drive to pull down loads of statues, in actual fact. And they've said they want to defund the police. They're against democracies. They're against capitalism. They're quite clearly a Marxist organisation. And football fans are very patriotic. They, you know, they support Winston Churchill and they support our statues. And they don't want to see football players getting down on their knees before a political organisation. As they said, why don't they just say, well, we're against racism, or we support kick racism out of football? Why do they have to support Black Lives Matter? And surely it is freedom of speech for the fans to boo if they want to boo. If it's okay for the England team to show their political loyalties, why is it not okay for the supporters to say, well, we don't agree with those political loyalties? There's a football match on Sunday, and apparently the England team have got lots of black players, and one of the black players has scored. But I think a lot of the people that would normally be supporting England are cheering on teams like Croatia that have said that they're not actually going to get down on their knees for this Marxist organisation. I don't really pay that much attention to the football. It's really just the political side of it that I've been following. But have you been following any of it, Max?
Well, I've been witnessing it on the news. It's of course, the whole main thrust of the Black Lives Matter movement is that they are trying to make white people feel that white people are still discriminating against black people in a significant way, that's harming the interests of black people and that is causing the unnecessary deaths of black people. Even though there is little or no evidence of this, because the majority of white people, irrespective of what white country you look at, have now been cowed into a situation where we don't say anything or do anything that might antagonize a non-white person. And so, even if what Black Lives Matter say was true once, it certainly isn't true now, and it hasn't been true for a long time. And it seems, and the thing that the Black Lives Matter people seem to ignore is that it's okay for the thing they seem to be happy to allow is discrimination against other races by non-white races. They don't seem to complain about Asians discriminating against blacks or Chinese discriminating against Asians or anything else. And it's quite evident that there is that kind of discrimination going on all over the world. The part of the world where that discrimination is going on the least is in the white countries of the world, because our populations, as I've said, have all been shamed into thinking that it's evil and iniquitous for them to look after the interests of their in-group in preference to looking after the interests of any out-group. But the fact that Black Lives Matter keep on going on and on and on about this in my view, amounts to incitement to racial hatred, because there was the young lady who was shot at the garden party not so long back, who was a member of the Black Panthers, and she was instrumental in creating the Black Lives Matter movement over here. If you read through the material produced by Black Panthers, they use the phrase Black Power. They are talking about the building up of Black Power, and that is obviously the black counterpart to white power. But if a white organization was standing in the streets giving a salute and calling for white power, then that would be regarded as incredibly racist and hateful, and it would be regarded as an incitement to racial hatred, and the white people doing that would be arrested and would be prosecuted. So why is it that organizations containing people who subscribe to the sort of black power ethos of the Black Panthers, why is it that they're allowed to continually criticize white people for doing what they do themselves?
Well, it's incredibly unpatriotic as well, isn't it? I mean, what they're doing is they're getting down on their knees. And the whole point of that was, instead of standing for the national anthem in America, Colin Kaepernick got down on his knees and said, well, I'm refusing to stand for the national anthem. So now we have the British football team that are all getting down on their knees and refusing to stand for the national anthem. I mean, that's what the symbolism of it actually is. And they're also giving credibility to this idea that there is systemic racism. I mean, we had this report that the government did a few weeks back, and they investigated everything, and they investigated all the claims of systemic racism, and they found there was no systemic racism in Britain. In actual fact, they found that Britain had the least amount of racism than any of the multicultural countries, and this is because they've put in all these anti-white policies, of course. But by going along with Black Lives Matter and saying that they support this, they're basically saying, we don't agree with the government's own report. We don't agree with this idea that Britain is not a racist country. We think that the police are racist, and they're going out and they're killing black people. Because, I mean, that's what Black Lives Matter is about. It's about American police and the high number of black criminals that end up getting shot by them. And it's always because they are resisting arrest, and all the ones that have ended up dying have also had criminal records. So they are black criminals, and they have been resisting arrest. And now you've got the British football team that are insisting on standing up for them. And you've got the football supporters who are just saying, well, all lives matter. Why can we not say white lives matter? Why is it that the lad that flew the White Lives Matter banner over Burnley on the weekend that three white people were attacked by an Islamic terrorist, why is it that he got banned from Burnley Football Club for life for doing that, for pointing out that white lives matter too? And I think that's the genuine general feeling that there is amongst football supporters, is that if the teams were to say we are supporting one of these football organisations that are against racism, they would support it. But because it's supportive of this Marxist political organisation that is against everything that is patriotic, they don't want to support it. And it's an embarrassment to see the English football team supporting it. It's good that the Scottish team have said that they won't be supporting it. And I think the Scottish rugby team have said that they're not supporting it either. And actually, when they had their football match on the Saturday night, Christian Eriksen had a heart attack, the Danish player, which is very suspicious. And then you look and you find out, of course, the question that everybody asks is, was he vaccinated? And yes, he was vaccinated 12 days ago. And of course, we will be told that it had nothing to do with the vaccination, but there has been a rather suspicious number of strokes and heart attacks and blood clots to do with people after they've had their vaccinations. And of course, they're trying to shame everybody into getting vaccinated, even young people at the moment. I've been asked a few times if I've been vaccinated, and they're trying to use this as an excuse now to push back the Freedom Day. We're supposed to have our Freedom Day on 21st of June, and Boris Johnson is going to give a speech. He's going to give a speech tonight, actually, as this goes out on the Monday. And we've been warned that he may put Freedom Day back by 2 weeks or a month. Apparently, he wants to put it back by a month, but he might say, we'll just put it back by 2 weeks, because that will please the Tory backbenchers and say, well, we can look at the numbers in 2 weeks' time. But of course, the fact is that nobody's dying of coronavirus now. We've had days when nobody at all has died of coronavirus. There may be a few more people that are turning up at hospital, but nobody is actually dying of it. And these vaccines don't protect you from it either in completely, because a lot of the people that have turned up at hospital have also actually been vaccinated. And I think half the people that have actually died of it from this India variant, even though it's only a very small number, something like 40 or 50, half of them have actually been vaccinated twice. So it's scandalous that they're trying to keep the country closed. They did a poll and they said that 30% of the public want the place to open up, and I think over 50% want to keep the restrictions going. I mean, who are the people that they were actually polling there? It can't have been anybody that actually owns any businesses. I mean, everybody's been looking forward to June the 21st. All the restrictions are going to be lifted, but no, it looks like that's not going to happen now. Have you had any thoughts on what they're talking about with this Freedom Day, delaying it, Max?
Well, it is just, I mean, very similar to what you've been saying, really, that the government just seemed to be obsessed with taking the most cautious approach possible, despite the fact that it's fairly evident that the most cautious approach is causing the demise of lots and lots of businesses. And so it may not be taking lives, but it's certainly taking people's businesses. And so there is still a tremendous amount of economic aftershock, which is going to follow throughout the course of this year. And I just wonder what the balance of wealth is going to be in this country, because it would seem to me that large companies that are able to obtain massive amounts of furlough money for their employees don't necessarily seem to be doing too badly. There are schemes that have been made available that have enabled large companies to obtain very low interest rate loans and things from the government. But there are lots of small business people who won't have qualified for those loans, who perhaps because they're self-employed won't be able to, although there have been some benefits that have been made available to them, who won't be able to furlough themselves, and they will eventually just go out of business. And so, you know, we've had a situation where even Andrew Lloyd Webber has stated that on the 21st he's going to open his theatres, and if the police want to arrest him, then they can do, but he is not going to, apparently not going to allow his theatres to stand empty any longer. And who can blame him?
Well, I hope he does stand up against it. I hope there is a movement amongst the people that says, well, no, this has been going on for too long. We've had enough of this now. I mean, they're even talking about having climate change lockdowns. This is another thing to do with the G7. They've been talking about what they're going to do about the climate, how they're going to change the weather, and we can't allow the weather to get too hot, never mind the fact that in the Middle Ages it was much warmer than it is now, and we used to have vineyards growing all over Britain, and the more carbon dioxide there is, the bigger the plants grow and the more produce there is. They're talking about having climate change lockdowns because this has done such a lot of good for the environment. And when they build back better, we've had Boris Johnson saying that he wants to build back gender neutral and in a more feminine way. And I thought, how can you build in a feminine way? When have we ever had female builders? When have women actually been responsible for building anything? They nurture the young of our people while the men go out and build things for the women. That's the way that it works. The women say, we want this, and we want this to be made easier, and the men design something and they create something to make life easier for the women. That's just the way that it goes.
What would say that? I think there probably are some female architects and some female builders. I do remember seeing a female builder on television only sort of like a month or so ago. But the point is, there isn't a female building style. So you could walk along the street and say, oh, that was a house designed by a woman, because you can tell it's a very feminine building. And that building over there was designed by a man because it's a very masculine building. Because building regulations being what they are, the houses built by women are very similar, and one would say indistinguishable from the buildings built by men. And so, you know, to claim that there would be a female rebuilding of Britain after the lifting of lockdown, it's just nonsense.
Well, also, what is this push to be gender neutral? You know, we've got a problem with transgenderism. We've got a huge problem with young people being confused about their gender. We also have testosterone levels that have dropped by 20% over the last 20 years. We also have dropping sperm levels. We have all these hormone disruptors in the environment. We have plastics. We have contraceptive pills. We have lots of estrogen in the environment. And we've got a serious problem with that. It's causing our children to be confused about their gender. So what is their answer to it? Well, we need everything to be gender neutral. We want to make people even more confused about their gender. I mean, it's completely the wrong way to go about things. They should be making things that are gender reinforcing. They should be reinforcing what gender a child is at an early age. They should be teaching boys to do boy things and teaching girls to do girl things so they don't become confused about their gender. I mean, the disease itself is gender dysphoria. It's not a good thing. It's not gender euphoria. It's the exact opposite of it. It's depression. It's suicidal. And we're encouraging this with this all this gender neutral nonsense. I think Boris Johnson really did put his foot in it, to be honest, when he said he's going to be building back gender neutral and more feminine. I mean, who knows what he means by building back more feminine. I can only just think of actual proper building. And as you say, Max, there are some female architects. I can remember one, actually, that did a particularly awful library that she won. I think it won a prize for it. It was somewhere in Manchester. Awful looking thing. Did you? And they made a big thing of the fact that it was a woman architect. And that doesn't really give me much hope for Boris Johnson's Build Back Better with a feminine slant to it. We got one other news story. We've got GB News.
Before we move on, I just wanted to just mention one thing about the current restrictions that are still continuing. I had reason to go to the bank earlier on this week, and I went along to my local bank branch, and the entrance to the bank was closed. But the entrance door to the bank opened into, you know, if it was open, it opened into a little room that was about 6 foot by 6 foot before you then turned left and went through a door into the main banking hall. But this door was shut, and it said that in the interests of social distancing, etc., would we please use the entrance to the rear and the entrance to the rear involved me walking about 200 yards down the road, turning into like a little, like very grotty, shabby little alley that I then walked down for about another 100 metres, turning left again, walking along for another 100 metres or so, and then into this courtyard at the back of the bank where there was a queue of people, and I joined the queue. And when I got to the front of the queue, the door that we were going into opened into the little 6x6 room that we would have gone into had they just left the door on the high street open. And so everybody that's been visiting that bank since lockdown began has been walking all this great long distance all the way around just in order to go back in through the same little 6x6 room that they would have gone into had they gone in through the front door, which is just absolutely absurd, isn't it?
It's like they're just trying to ridicule us, aren't they? They're just trying to see how far they can push us. I mean, wearing these masks is ridiculous enough, as if viruses can't go down through your tear ducts in your eyes. You know, everybody's wearing a mask, and yet you've got these two great big holes above the mask for the virus to go in. You know, it's just none of it actually makes any common sense. We do have a new news channel starting on Sunday night, GB News, which is presented by Andrew Neil. Apparently it's going to be a 24-hour rolling news channel, and they say that it's going to be a challenge to BBC and Sky. And Andrew Neil has always presented himself as a bit of an alternative. He's not really right-wing, he's not really left-wing, but he has put himself forward as somebody that is against the social justice nonsense and all the woke nonsense. So that will be interesting to see. I mean, it's good to see that there is going to be an alternative. I'm not holding out much hope for it. I don't think they'll be interviewing Mark Collett or asking about Patriotic Alternative or anything like that. But I think they will probably have people on there like Toby Young and his Free Speech Union. They might have Jordan Peterson on there. I guess that will probably be about as edgy as they would get, is interviewing Jordan Peterson. But at least that will be a nice change. And perhaps we might see some pushback against these coronavirus lockdowns. That there have been quite a few mainstream people that have pushed back against it, particularly in the music scene. There was Noel Gallagher from Oasis. Who else has there been? It's gone right out of my mind. The old blues guy. And also there's been Roger Waters. He's pushed back against it. Why can't I remember the name of the guy who did this song, Who Runs the Media?
I don't know. I can't think of who it was either.
Morrison. Something Morrison. Van Morrison.
Ah, right, yes.
Van Morrison. Van Morrison came out with a track called Who Owns the Media? And What Are You Doing on Facebook? And Which Way Western Man? This lockdown really has woken a lot of people up, and it is a nice change to actually see people from the mainstream that are actually challenging this, because you would hope that they would go a little bit further and question, you know, who is it that's actually running things? Because quite clearly it's all being run by the banks. And to have someone of such a stature as Van Morrison actually singing about this, I mean, that really is a turn up for the books. But yeah, we'll have to wait and see what GB News is like, and whether Andrew Neil actually does provide a genuine alternative to the mainstream media and the fake news conglomerates. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Max. Anything else that piqued your curiosity over the last week?
Well, I think it is good, as you say, that there are lots of people now that are speaking out against what is being called woke. These are all people that would probably cringe and shrink back if anybody suggested that they were moving in our direction ideologically. But I mean, the fact of the matter is that they are, because woke was originally a term that was introduced by people who are woke, and it was meant to indicate that it was meant to be a compliment. But we are the people who turned woke into an insult. And now all the woke people are crying about it, and the fact that they're being ridiculed for being woke. It just reminded me of a book that was written by Jonathan Bowden, the late Jonathan Bowden, called Extremists. And in the book that he wrote, he kind of pointed out that societies very often move in different directions, but it requires the people that that get labelled extremist in order to be the vanguard of the movement in that direction. And I see us as being the vanguard. We are labelled as extremists when really we're not extreme at all. But we certainly are the vanguard in terms of us fighting back against woke.
Well, I never thought Van Morrison would be labelled as an extremist, but he certainly is nowadays. Right, well, shall we get into our greatest Britons for today then, Max?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, our greatest Briton for today is Robert Peel Glanville Blatchford, and we'll start with a recap from last week. Robert Blatchford's parents were both in show business, and I thought it was actually Henry Ford who had a similar upbringing, but it was actually George Lincoln Rockwell, so it was same nationality, but quite a few decades later that I was thinking of. Blatchford's father died when he was young, and his own two children also died young, and it may have been this that encouraged him to see socialism as the answer to society's ills. His writing life began with the Sunday Chronicle, and he was soon writing about his own type of patriotic socialism that had nothing to do with Marxism or internationalism. In 1891, he started his own newspaper, The Clarion, which he then distributed himself via Clarion vans that would then be met by activists on bicycles from the Clarionettes, a cycling club that had formed around the newspaper. By this time, he had joined the British Labour movement, founded the Manchester Fabian Society, and become the independent Labour candidate for Bradford East. And he was also forced to leave the Sunday Chronicle due to his political stance. And I was quite surprised to find that the Clarionettes are actually still going. And that was timed to coincide with the change from the penny farthing to the modern style of bicycle. And it's quite interesting that we still have that same style of bicycle. It's lasted for 100 years. It must have been a very top of the range engineering idea to actually come up with those two triangles, because it just hasn't been able to be improved upon really over the last 100 years. But that's what I recall from last week. Max, is there anything you want to add to that?
No, just apart from to say that you do see penny farthings from time to time, and I find it amazing that anybody actually thought of them as a serious mode of transport, because it's you're so high up, so far forward, over the large front wheel, that as soon as you hit any bump, you're just going to go over the handlebars. And so obviously any improved bicycle design that adopted since then would naturally be called a safety bicycle.
Yeah, and the double triangle frame, it was such an improvement. I mean, they haven't been able to improve upon it since. I mean, a real triumph of engineering that was. Well, Blatchford supported the Boer War, which lost him support from some sections of the labour movement, causing him to denounce his cosmopolitan friends, who are so cosmopolitan that they can admire every country but their own and love all men except English men. He criticised the smug, self-righteous prigs in the labour movement who, while despising military glory, are yet so eloquent over the marksmanship and courage of the Boers. He wrote that while his whole heart is with the British troops, when England is at war, I'm English. I have no politics and no party. I am English. Responding to claims from the right-wing press that he wanted to turn people against their country, he retorted that he wanted to make people so fond of their country that they shall desire to possess it. I'll just stop there, because that's really interesting, isn't it? It was the people on the left that were supporting the Boers. And he stood out from the left wing movement really by supporting the English. And of course today nationalists will really say that, you know, what was Britain doing going to war against the Boers? And it's more people on the right that will support the Boers. So there's been a change there. Would you say, Max? You got any thoughts on these quotes here from him?
Yeah, I think. It's true what you point out. I wasn't that aware, to be quite honest, that that support for the Boers came from the left. I think as far as the Boers are concerned, they were Dutch people primarily who went out to Africa and wanted to farm, but who didn't want to be under the hegemony of the British Empire. And that was the cause really of the Boer War. They kept retreating further and further inland from their original lands that they established in the Cape Colony in order to try and move so far that they would escape the clutches of the British Empire. But obviously our armies, etc., just continued to advance behind them, and eventually they decided to stand and fight. I think the Boer War was a very unfortunate war that took place, but one of the things that it showed up were the limitations of the British Army at the time, because the British Army had been designed to take part in set-piece infantry manoeuvres with the support of cavalry and artillery. And the Boers practiced guerrilla warfare, which is something which was quite new, and the British soldiers had great difficulty really struggled at certain points against the Boers, until eventually they were able to overcome the resistance. And I think the overcoming the resistance was a pretty brutal affair, and a lot of Boer people nowadays still bear a grudge against Britain for the brutal repression of the Boer rebellions.
You know, I think there was a scorched earth policy, and there was concentration camps as well that Churchill was involved in. Not something really to be proud of. But I think we can also see here that he puts his ethnicity first. His ethnicity is more important than his politics. He says, "When England is at war, I'm English. I have no politics and no party. I am English." So even though what he has there is what we've referred to before as petty nationalism or jingoism, it's essentially correct. You know, it is more important. Your extended family are more important than the politics you have. And he is saying he identifies more with his extended family than somebody who has the same politics with him, who is not a part of that extended family. So even though he was a nationalist, even though he was a socialist, he was also very, very definitely a nationalist. And this was a time when the two could coexist together. After the war, Blatchford continued to agitate for a united socialist party and supported the London Progressive Party. He was critical of the Labour Party, which was founded in 1900, for what he perceived as its complete subservience to liberalism, especially in its Cobdenite internationalist views on foreign policy. Blatchford said of himself and his colleagues at the Clarion, "We were out for socialism and nothing but socialism, and we were Britain's first and socialists next." So he's quite clearly against internationalism, and he's associating that with Cobdenite views rather than Marxist views, and he sees it as liberalism, whereas later on we saw that liberalism was seen as a bulwark against communism by the time we actually got to Rudyard Kipling. Have you got any thoughts on this, Max?
Well, I think it's just interesting that you know, so many of the slogans that have been adopted by the right over the course of the last century were slogans that were pretty much invented by Robert Blatchford. Britain's first, socialist next, Britain for the British, and I'm sure that if we look for them, there'll be lots more that are there, and it shows a continuity from Robert Blatchford all the way through to modern nationalist organisations.
It was patriotic socialism, I guess, national socialism in Germany and patriotic socialism in Britain. He criticised free trade from an economic nationalist perspective. Free trade had made it impossible for Britain to feed herself, and it had destroyed British agriculture. This was especially serious in wartime because Britain could be starved into submission due to the dependence on foreign countries for her food. But when Joseph Chamberlain launched his crusade for tariff reform in 1903, Blatchford's response was ambiguous. He did not formally endorse Chamberlain's campaign, but the Clarion praised its aims: the revival of British agriculture, a self-sufficient empire, and a producer-focused instead of consumer-focused economic system. Blatchford said he did not believe in tariff reform as applied by the Conservatives, but that a socialist government would find it a necessary instrument. So I think what we had here, we were relying on getting food over from India, and it didn't just cause problems for Britain that we had to import our food. It also caused problems for India. It also caused famines in India because we would take all the corn and send that over to Britain, and then they would have bad weather in India, and they wouldn't have the corn and the rice that they needed. I mean, that eventually led to millions of people dying during the Second World War when Churchill diverted the rice that had been intended for the Indians, and then they ended up having bad weather. And that's one of the main accusations against Churchill, in actual fact, was that he killed millions of these Indians by doing this. I think it was in Bangalore, the drought that happened, and all the people that actually starved. So you can see that this sort of thing was happening back in 1903. Britain was far too reliant on foreigners, and he didn't want Britain to be reliant on foreigners. He wanted us to be self-sufficient and producing our own food. And you were telling me last week that it was also the quality of the food that he was interested in, Max.
He was interested in the quality of it. I mean, this whole issue really revolves around autarky and being self-sufficient. One of the things that is a criticism of the sort of colonial era, and that's a criticism of international trade since the demise of the colonial era, has been that poor countries in the world are induced by presumably financial inducements being given to their leaders, so that their leaders will sort of implement these policies. But there are instances where a country will produce something like palm oil, for example, and they will throw all of their agriculture over into producing palm oil, so that it can then be sold internationally, and so that with the money they raise from selling it internationally, they can then buy enough food from the food producing countries in order to feed their people. And of course, when a developing country has its entire industry turned over to producing one crop, which is of that sort, if there is a crop failure, or if for whatever reason the international price of palm oil or whatever the crop happens to be drops very suddenly, then that country finds itself in a situation where it doesn't have enough money to feed itself, and so therefore that type of economics is one of the primary causes of famine around the world. And as far as Robert Blatchford was concerned, he identified this as a problem not just for developing countries in the third world, but it was also a problem for countries in the developed world. And he could see that if we didn't produce all of our own food, or at least the vast majority of our own food, then our nation was therefore vulnerable to blockades by other nations, and so therefore that we would be as a nation weakened, and as a world power we would be weakened. And one of the aspects of British farming that Blatchford investigated and he produced I think a pamphlet or a book called Feeding England, and this was basically that he together with a British nobleman, they identified that the yield of potatoes per acre was such that it would be possible to feed it would feed 200 million people from the arable land that's available in the British Isles, and that would have included Southern Ireland at that time, I would have assumed. And so what he said was that there is absolutely no reason why we are importing 50% plus of our food, because we've got enough arable land to actually produce all the food that we could possibly have. And believe it or not, you can actually live on potatoes. All the nutrients that are necessary for life are contained within a potato. And that's obviously why, as far as the Irish were concerned, they produced lots of potatoes, the poor subsistence farmers in Southern Ireland, and why when there was the potato famine that they suffered so badly from it. But the point is that had we pursued a policy of autarky, then we would have had the capacity to feed ourselves. Now, not everybody's going to want to eat potatoes all the time, but we didn't need to produce we didn't need to only produce potatoes, because the population of Britain at that time was only about 50 million. And so with around about a quarter of the arable land that we had, we would have been able to have fed the entire population on potatoes. But then the other three quarters of all the arable land could have been used to to grow other products or other plant-based foods, etc., or even to make it available for grazing, so that meat products could be produced, so that there would be a variety of diet. And had we followed that kind of a policy, then during the First World War, when there was the attempted blockade of Britain by German U-boats, and during the Second World War, when there was the attempted blockade of Britain by German U-boats, that wouldn't have threatened us at all, because we could have continued to feed ourselves irrespective of whether there was a blockade or not.
No, I think that potato famine, that was partially caused by the British Empire taking all the potatoes to sell to somewhere else. And I think at this time there was also rickets and scurvy in the children, and he was concerned about the diet that the working classes were eating. There was also offal and bits of animals that we wouldn't think of eating today that they were eating back then.
Yes, my grandmother used to tell a story about when she was a young girl of about 13, and she was sent by her mother down to the grocer's shop on the corner to buy a boiled sheep's head for the family's dinner that evening. And within the half a boiled sheep's head, there was one eye, and that one eye was always regarded as a delicacy. And my great grandfather always used to eat the eye. But as my grandmother was carrying this bag home with the half a boiled sheep's head in it, she looked into the bag, and the eye just appeared so delicious to her that she plucked the eye out and ate it. And then when she got home, she was then confronted by her mother, who wanted to know why this half a sheep's head didn't have an eye in it. And my grandmother was too afraid to confess that she'd eaten it. And so my great-grandmother sent her back to the shop to demand that it be exchanged for half a boiled sheep's head with an eye in it. And my grandmother went back, and luckily the shopkeeper took pity on her and gave her another half of all sheep's head that she could then take back home to her father.
I gotta say, I think your great-grandmother must have known what actually happened to that eye. I think that was to teach her a lesson, to send her back to get another one. Thankfully the butcher helped her out. Yeah, lots of things that you just wouldn't dare eat today, and you do wonder what the effect of that was on the people that were eating them. And he was certainly concerned about that, as we will see. A further development in Blatchford's thinking cost him more readers when he began denouncing organised religion in works such as God and My Neighbour in 1903 and Not Guilty, A Defence of the Bottom Dog in 1905. But he gained readers with Merry England, which was a series of articles on socialism from the Clarion, published in book form in 1893. The first edition sold 30,000 copies, and the year after, a pocket-sized edition was published, selling 25,000 copies. A penny edition was published in 1894, with 250,000 copies being ordered before publication, and within a year, 750,000 copies had been dispatched across the English-speaking world. In Britain and America, the book would go on to sell over 2 million copies. In the opinion of Robert Enzer, the book helped to make socialism really well known in England for the first time. It was Blatchford's highest flight as a propagandist. He never surpassed it, and through it, mainly, he left his mark upon history. The book was translated into Welsh, Hebrew, Dutch, Italian, Spanish, and German. William Thomas Stead picked the book as the Review of Reviews Book of the Month and called Blatchford the poor man's Plato. Dr. Horton, the Congregationalist minister, compared Blatchford to Isaiah, Amos, and Micah, and said that if Jesus Christ were a man on earth today, he would read the book not only with interest but with approval, and he would say to any officious disciples who took exception to parts of it, "Forbid him not, he that is not against me is for me." C.P. Scott of the Manchester Guardian wrote to Blatchford saying, "I have been reading Merry England and find a great deal in it." The Manchester Guardian said that for every British convert to socialism made by Das Kapital, there were 100 made by Merry England. At the Oxford Union, a motion was approved by 103-54 that stated that the aims of the socialist tract Merry England are but the baseless fabric of a vision. And the motion was seconded by Hilary Belloc. Do you want to make any comments on that, Max? You've had a good read of this book, haven't you, this Merry England book?
That's right. I do actually have a copy of it. The One of the things that people very often experience when they take part in elections and they're canvassing on behalf of nationalist candidates is that they will get to a house where they will talk to somebody who will then express views that are identical to those espoused by the nationalist organisation. And the canvasser will then say to them, well, will you, can we count on your vote then in the election? And they'll say, oh, no, my family have always voted Labour. My father voted Labour and his father before him and his father before him. And the point is that when they say that, very often the nationalist canvasser will turn and walk away feeling dejected because they think, how can I get through to somebody who has that sort of an attitude? But the response that we need to have coming back in those situations is, well, then if your grandfather and his father before him and his father before him voted Labour, then it's almost certain that they would have become a nationalist, a socialist as a result of reading Blatchford's Merry England, in which case they would have agreed with the views that we espouse now because they are the views that Blatchford espoused all those generations back. And so despite the fact that the Labour Party has changed its opinion and its position, we have remained loyal to the ideology espoused by Robert Blatchford and the ideology that won almost all the supporters that the Labour Party had when it first began.
So this is the reason why people support Labour then, really, because, I mean, they do. They say, well, I vote Labour because my father voted Labour and my grandfather voted Labour, and this must have been the reason why everybody started voting Labour. And then I guess they just got stuck with it, because, I mean, it does. It's just common sense, really, that you would do things for the benefit of your people, and you'd have, I mean, if you can imagine back then him seeing what Britain is like today with foreigners in the government and foreigners running everything, I think he'd be absolutely shocked. I don't think he could have foreseen this. He thought it was bad enough when we had British people that were running things and that were doing things out of greed rather than actually doing what was best for the people of the nation. Well, Blatchford was also a vegetarian, and in Merry England, he mentioned the economic, health and humanitarian benefits of a vegetarian diet. So you've got a similarity there with Adolf Hitler. I didn't realise that vegetarianism actually had such a following back then. I thought it was a fairly recent thing, but I mean, this is 120 years ago you actually had
vegetarians. And I'm a vegetarian myself.
Yes. And I must say, you are very fit and healthy for a vegetarian, Max. Quite surprising compared to some. So you must know exactly what it is to eat to keep yourself fit. Do you want to talk a bit about being a vegetarian before we get into this?
I think that the biggest mistake that people make when they become vegetarians is that they just stop eating meat. And the point is, if you just stop eating meat, then you will have a deficiency in your diet from all the things that you were previously eating from all the nutrients that you previously ate that came from meat. Now, if you're going to stop eating meat, then you've got to find the plant sources that provide the proteins and other things that are missing in some vegetables. And so it's a matter of making sure that you've got a balanced diet from the vegetable based foods that you're actually eating.
Would you be able to be a vegetarian just eating a diet that was grown in Britain, or do you have to get foods from elsewhere for that?
No, I could certainly survive on food just from Britain. As I said to you earlier on, you can get all the nutrients you'd need from a potato. I mean, if you just ate nothing but potatoes, it wouldn't be that good for you because you would put weight on because of all the carbohydrate. But the point is, you wouldn't actually starve to death, and everything that you would need to be able to live on would be able to be provided by the potato. So it's then just really a matter of looking at other vegetables that provide what's missing from your diet once you stop eating meat.
And is it something that you have to really know a lot about nutrition to do? I mean, have you read quite a few books on it and studied up on it before you decided to change your diet like that, or is it just something, you know, very, very straightforward that you can do?
Well, you don't need to know a tremendous amount. One of the things that I did was I became vegetarian, and then I spent a time becoming actually vegan, where I didn't even eat things like milk or eggs or anything dairy. And I've continued not to eat most dairy products, although, you know, if I go and visit somebody and they make me a cup of tea with milk in it, I'm not going to turn my nose up at it. I'll just drink the cup of tea out of politeness. But the point is, and quite often if I'm out and I stop off at a cafe and get a cup of coffee, and the only food to eat there is like a bun or something that's going to have milk and an egg in it, then I'll still eat it because there's nothing else. And it's eat that or go hungry. And the point is that when I'm at home, though, I have continued to concentrate on a plant-based diet, but I have started eating eggs as well. So I'm not a vegan any longer. I am back as a vegetarian, because I think that there are nutrients that you can get from vegetables, but it's much easier just to get them from eggs. And so I eat a certain amount of eggs that give me the nutrients that otherwise would be missing.
Yeah, I don't think it's natural to keep having dairy products as an adult, is it? When you're a child, you're supposed to have your mother's milk. And then when you're an adult, I don't think you're supposed to keep having milk, because it can upset the body. I stopped using milk quite a few years back. I used to have a runny nose all the time. And someone said, well, you know, that could be some of the additives that are put in with the milk. And I switched to almond milk, and that stopped the runny nose. But I do like butter. I love butter. And I think we've been eating butter for thousands of years. You know, it features in old religious texts as being something almost holy. And butter is really good for you. Lashings of butter, I think. You know, certainly wouldn't want to go anywhere near margarine. Do you have butter at all, Max? What are your thoughts on butter?
I have started eating butter again, mainly because I didn't like I investigated into margarines and didn't really like what I read about them in terms of them producing various trans fats, which are very of dubious benefit to anybody. And so in order to avoid trans fats, I've gone back to eating butter with a little bit of vegetable oil mixed in, but it is primarily butter. That again, I suppose, is another element where I've gone back to vegetarianism rather than veganism. I think, though, as far as humanity as a whole were concerned, humanity as a whole was originally lactose intolerant. Children could drink milk from cows because they had been raised on a diet of breast milk from their mothers. But once you stopped having a diet of breast milk from your mother, it then led on to you becoming lactose intolerant in later life. But the populations within the Middle East and Europe who developed animal husbandry and who therefore had substantial quantities of milk and cheese derived from that, they persisted in eating milk and cheese despite the fact that they experienced a degree of lactose intolerance, until eventually all those that exhibited lactose intolerance had died out over a period of centuries, and only those who were lactose tolerant survived. And that's why, as far as Europe is concerned and the peripheral areas of Asia and North Africa, lactose tolerance is most common in those areas, and probably something like 80% of the populations of Europe and the Middle East and North Africa are lactose tolerant. Whereas if you go beyond that, if you go to Africa south of the Sahara, if you go to the Far East, what you find is that lactose intolerance is much, you know, becomes the dominant situation. And so people from those areas find it very difficult to live on a diet that's got any milk in it. And a lot of African tribes who have herds of cattle where they milk them to provide food for their children, once the individual becomes an adult, then what they do is they drink the cow's blood, and there is a process by which they puncture one of the arteries in a cow's neck and then drain blood into a receptacle, and there are tribes there that who drink cow's blood in the same way that we drink milk.
That's the Maasai tribe that do that. I mean, it's one of the racial differences, isn't it? That, you know, white people can tolerate milk and then the other races can't. And it's similar with alcohol as well. White people can tolerate alcohol, but some of the races, like the Eskimos, they have real problems with alcohol. Well, I think we should probably leave that here, and we'll get into some of the quotes from Merry England next week, unless you've got anything else that you want to add before we finish, Max?
No, that's fine. I look forward to next week.
Okay, thank you very much for coming on today.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.